Midnight in Karachi with Mavish Marad on tour.com. Today I'm joined by writer Sarah Lotz, whose horror novel The Three made a big splash last year. Her follow-up novel is Day Four, a creepy claustrophobic story set on a cruise ship that somehow stalled in the middle of the ocean in the middle of nowhere. It's like Ballard's High Rise, except on water and with way too many drunk singles on the cruise. Sarah is also the co-writer of a series of really great urban horror novels, the co-writer of a series of young adult zombie novels, as well as one-third of a writing trio of a series of choose-your-own-adventure erotic novels. Sarah, welcome to Midnight in Karachi.
Thank you. It's brilliant to chat to you again.
Now, this giant list of work you do, books you've written, you've obviously been writing for years and years, and then suddenly, with The Three, it felt like your work was getting the attention and praise of, well, a lot more people in the mainstream. People like Stephen King, for God's sakes. I mean, that's huge. And this move to a more mainstream, shall we say, culture or reader's culture, how has that been for you?
Well, I think that I would say that I am a mainstream writer. I mean, I may have written lots of books before The Three, before I wrote The Three, but they were all pretty mainstream, and they were, I wrote some crime, and my first novel, Pompidou Posse, which is a sort of semi-autobiographical book about two girls who live on the streets of Paris, is being re-released by Hodder. So it's kind of come a massive full circle, which has been really weird, because I think when Pompidou Posse was published in South Africa in 2007, it literally had about three readers. I think there are three people in the planet that read it, and two of them I'm related to. So the fact that it's now going to be re-released is a bit weird.
Now that Pompidou Posse is being republished, and I believe it's later this year, are you going to go back and make any changes? Are you ready to just let it go out the way it was before?
Oh gosh, I've actually re-edited it. I cut out 12,000 words, and some of the writing in it was just mortifying. I think it always is with the first book. I actually wrote the line, "I'm sorry, I say apologetically," which had to go. There's an awful lot.
That's like, really, fantastic.
And so many adverbs. Oh my God. I love adverbs, but there was just too many. It was like, I had to commit adverb genocide on the book. So, but that was great to go back. But I wanted to still keep it sort of raw, because then that would be a shame, I think, if you went back. And I think every writer would like to go back and rewrite all their books from scratch completely. And I think there's something to be said to be able to go back and read your old stuff and say, all right, you know, I didn't get it right the first time. But one of the things about being published in South Africa first, which was great, especially during that time, was that you were allowed to fail. So in your career, you could have a book that necessarily was a bit of a flop or didn't necessarily do well. So you could learn on the job, which I think is what you used to do in sort of the olden days. Nowadays, I think it's much harder. I think if your first novel doesn't do well, you're very unlikely to get picked up by a publisher, and trying to maintain that career is a lot harder.
Now, I know you wrote The Three partly because you're flight phobic and you're still fascinated by the idea of flying, but you got on a plane, you went to Japan, you did all this research. With Day Four, we've got a cruise ship that pretty much just stalls out in the ocean in the middle of nowhere. And then, of course, things start to unravel really horribly. Where did this premise come from?
Again, I think pretty much all of my books stem from, especially the horror novels, stem from a shared theme that I'm a claustrophobia, I suppose, and a thought of being somewhere surrounded by strangers with nowhere to go, and you're trapped. And I've always, as well as being scared of flying, I think I'm probably scared of everything. I'm also frightened of ships and and the ocean, and it's completely pathetic. My worst nightmare, apart from being on a plane, is being on a ship that's surrounded by a bunch of people, most of whom would be drunk and out of control, and probably in a quite smelly environment with bad food and cabaret. And it's all of my worst things. So I'm basically writing out my worst nightmare again.
You're scared of everything, says the horror novelist.
I like that. Pathetic, really, seriously, it is pathetic.
Now, I heard you did go on a singles cruise as part of your research. Is that true?
Yeah, I did. We went on one of the, there's a whole different echelon of cruises. There's lots of different kinds of cruises you can go on. So I think in the Day Four, I was really sort of looking at the very sort of lower end of the market, which I do think are problematic. They load and they herd people onto them. They treat their staff absolutely appallingly. So, and I decided, well, to really get a taste of this, it's not very well talking to people who worked on cruise ships. I have to actually experience one. I took my husband on, I made him come with me, and we did a price cruise to Mexico from Miami, and it was really horrible. It was everything I hoped it would be for writing a book, because it was full of people who were absolutely blindingly drunk all the time. And just watching the cynicism of the cruise industry, where you buy a cabin for zero money, but then there's lots of hidden costs. So at the end of the cruise, you end up like sort of completely in debt, you know. And the main reason I went on is to speak to the people who worked on these cruises, most of who are from like developing nations, third world nations, and hearing about their day-to-day life, which was really the stuff of horror.
Did you and your husband get along at the end of this cruise?
Yeah,
that's what I really want to know.
No, we always get along. Like, if you look at all the photos that I took of us, you know, for research, in every single one of them he's frowning. Absolutely miserable as sin. I think by the end, the last day he'd had enough. He couldn't take it anymore, because it was it was like being inside a giant cut price casino, and with flashing neon, and everything smelled a bit like sewage all the time. I don't know why. So that kind of put him off as well. It was horrendous, and nobody said thank you. That was another weird thing. It's like no one ever thanked in the dining room. No one ever said thank you to a waiter. They would just sit there and scoff down the food and never say thank you. It was very odd, very odd.
So everyone on it basically has a weird sense of entitlement, which I think is interesting, because in very much in your book too, right in the beginning, when everyone's sort of, you know, happy with the cruise and things are fine, there is a sense of, well, we're just going to do what we're going to do. There are, I mean, not to give any details away from the book, but there are characters who have a huge sense of entitlement and are rude to the staff and all the rest of it. And of course, when, you know, the high and mighty fall, they fall very badly.
Yeah. No, I wanted that. And I mean, I wanted the majority of the characters as well to, you know, be people that work on these ships, because I think everyone knows about cruises. And I mean, there's like, you know, things like the Poseidon Adventure and, I don't know, all that kind of stuff. Everyone has a picture in their head of what they are, but I don't think anyone really knows what goes on behind the scenes, the hundreds of people that you need to make these things work. And if you're doing it on a very narrow margin, then those people aren't going to be paid very much, and they aren't necessarily going to be treated very well. So that to me, that whole sort of hidden sort of class system of the ships, I found quite fascinating.
Now, did you go straight into day four from the three, or were you ever sort of writing both at the same time? And if so, was it tough to separate the voices of both novels? Because each novel did have a fairly large range of perspectives involved.
I wrote day four after I finished the three. But I wanted day four to be a completely different format, because how awful would it be to like read the three and then go and pretty much read something that mirrors that exactly. I think that would be just an absolute cop-out.
Yeah.
So I deliberately went about it in a completely different way. But yeah, I'm greedy with characters. I'm obviously clearly fascinated by people. I mean, who isn't? And no, there's no writer that can say that they're not. And it's a massive challenge to get into someone's head. And sometimes, I get it right, sometimes I don't. But it's great fun imagining someone else's life.
I'm really fascinated by how you manage these really different writing careers, as it were, if we can call them that. You've got these great big two spectacular horror novels. You've got the Choose Your Own Adventure erotic novels. You've got Zombie YA. You've got the quieter urban horror. I keep thinking of them as the quieter urban horror series that you do. they're just something about, you know, they're just, oh, this, I love those. I do. The S.L. Grey stuff is fantastic, but somehow they're more contained. Do any of these stories ever start sort of seeping into each other and driving you mad? Because, I mean, how do you draw the lines, the definitions that stop one story from melting into another? How do you decide, no, this idea is great and I'm going to keep it for this one and not that one?
I think it's just what fits at the time. And the often the themes do run into each other. I mean, there's a lot of the next S.L. Grey, which is called Underground, definitely has parallels with the whole theme of claustrophobia, which both Louis, he's my better co-writer on it, my better half, He definitely shares my fear of claustrophobia. And then the things like the tree had definite, and my zombie YA that I wrote with my daughter definitely had parallels with things like the Essel Gray book, The Mall. You know, there was a mall in, I was fascinated by malls when I was writing the YA, and you know, that came through in the adult horror as well. So I think that there is some crossover as well as the, but as far as the stories and the characters are concerned, they do seem to be compartmentalized. And the reason that I do, I always write another book, even if sometimes I've got lots of books that will never be published, that I write at the same time as I'm writing something else, because I can't just concentrate on one thing. I need to jump to another thing, because it's a weird sort of, like, I don't know why, it's a weird palate cleanser sort of thing. It sounds weird. In between each book.
I thought you said panic cleanser, but you said palate cleanser,
No,
didn't
panic.
you?
Have like one of those posh meals. You have
Yeah.
like a really posh
No,
meal, and they give you like a
I
sauce.
understand completely. I heard initially heard that as a panic cleanser, and it sort of made sense as well because, if you get really panicked about one thing, you move on to do so. I do this when I have lots of work. I can't finish one thing, so I move on to another, and it makes you feel less of the panic. Maybe that's just me.
No, it is. No, it totally isn't just you. It is if I get stuck, like a writing knot, which I can't unpick, then I'll go to the other thing I'm writing and pick the knot that's no doubt happened there, and then go back. And suddenly it's somehow as if my brain is subconsciously being sorting out the other one. I don't know why. It's probably just madness, I think. I think
Yeah.
it's just
Yes.
being a bit insane.
We'll just write it off as insanity.
Yes.
So how are you doing this nowadays? Are you just are you writing X number of words a day? Do you just work by deadline? How is it working out for you managing all these different things?
I love working to a deadline. I really find it helps, but I honestly just really do love the process. I find it difficult to talk about a book after I finish writing it, because it's all about the writing. It's like when it comes out, it's almost, well, it's gone now. It's got to do what it will. I've got no control over that. I only have the control over the actual writing of it, and the, you know, and even not necessarily over the editing of it. It's the, so when it goes out, it's, I really do, it's almost like I've broken up with it, like it's an ex-husband or an ex-boyfriend or something,
And then
which
when
is
it
quite,
comes back to be edited.
it comes back to be edited, and then we have a big fight. But no, I mean, the editing's generally, I've been very lucky with editors. I've got brilliant editor for the on day four and the three, and brilliant editor for the Essel Gray book. So I've been very fortunate with that. But generally, it's no, I really honestly, it's all about the writing for me. I find the rest of the stuff incredibly difficult to deal with.
You grew up with reading and loving writers like Stephen King. What scared you most when you were a kid? What kept you up at night, terrified to even close your eyes for a second, in case what would happen? What were your biggest fears when you were growing up?
It was always the watching like horror movies, 1970s and 80s horror movies, far too young. It was always the thing in the closet. Always, 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 always the thing in the wardrobe. And still, it still is. I mean, I do sometimes still check under the bed before I go to sleep. And I had quite a traumatic incident last year that was sort of all your sort of worst fears brought to life. And I found that it's kind of made it worse. So I now, obviously, it's made it worse. And so I really do sort of have to have the light on all the time and check in any cupboards, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And that is, I know, directly fed by what I went through when I was a kid with the sort of, it's the fear of the boogeyman, isn't it? Bogeyman. But it's a bogeyman. Bogeyman. No, it's bogeyman, isn't it? Bogeyman's a different thing.
Well, the only boogeyman I know is well, there's a boogey monster in the Powerpuff Girls who sends a massive disco ball up into the sky, and he makes everything into an all-night disco. I don't know why I remember this.
Yeah, not him.
Not him. He was kind of cool.
Yes, I'd always, yeah, I know.
Him, I could get along with. He was all right. But that's interesting to me that it's still that fear of sort of the unknown thing just around the corner or just in the closet. And it's interesting that that remains, even though, as you said, there have been, when you grow up and you're an adult, you see what you should really be scared of, things that can and do and have happened to people in real life. I mean, those are the things you should be scared of, and yet you're scared of this sort of imaginary creature that could be hiding in your closet when you know it isn't.
Yeah, but I think that imaginary creature is just a kind of convenient manifestation of all those sort of other fears that you've been through. I mean, I just think it's all, you know, it's just a kind of an easier way to deal with it. And of course, you can't explain it, can you? I mean, it's irrational. It's an irrational fear. You know, intellectually, and it's an irrational fear. I mean, especially when you've felt real fear, real fear, that which, you know, I think that probably most people have, and you compare it to the sort of fear you feel when you read a book or you watch a movie or whatever. I suppose it's kind of that imaginary thing is the marriage of those two things. God, I'm really sounding arsy now.
No, not at all. It makes sense. Of course, it doesn't explain, you know, why you put creepy kids into everything. You freak me out with creepy kids, Sarah. You do. And I'm not kidding. You did make me afraid of my own child once. When she walked into, like, my, you know, darkened room, and I was like, oh my. I mean, it was horrible. So thank you for that.
I'm very sorry, but I'm also very glad. But I mean, kids are terrifying, aren't they? I mean, kids can come out with saying incredible things.
Yes.
I mean, I had an imaginary friend when I was a kid, like a proper imaginary friend that I used to talk to. I don't know, lots of children do. But I think that my daughter never did, thank goodness, because I think it would have absolutely terrified me to have witnessed her having a full-on conversation with an imaginary friend.
All right, now you've lived in quite a few places in the world through the course of your life. Your books are set in different cities and different countries. Has there been any one place that you've lived in that's had more of an impact on your work than any of the others?
Oh, well, I was spending 20 years in Cape Town, I mean, in South Africa and Cape Town. I mean, that's in the setting in a lot of the books. But, and weirdly, now I'm kind of living in the UK. I'm wondering if I will start setting books here, even though I grew up in the UK. So that's going to be sort of an interesting sort of thing to look at, because I never necessarily, when I'm thinking about a book, I don't sort of, it just arrives, the idea arrives, it starts off and then it builds and builds, and I don't necessarily think, well, I need to write about the place that I know. I mean, if for some reason I feel like I need to set a book in Nepal, then that's what I'm going to do. But it was, you know, which conveniently would mean having to go on a research trip, which is never a bad thing.
So now your first novel, Pompadour Posse, is being republished later this year. Day 4 is out this month in May. And what's next for you? What future nightmares are you going to give me now?
Well, I've got a couple of ideas of stuff to write, but I haven't completely made my mind up yet.
There's an S.L. Grey book out soon, isn't there?
Oh, yeah, and then the Underground's coming out in June. Which is, it's kind of like a slight departure from my usual sort of stuff. It's been a bit of a fun experiment to see, to write, and we thoroughly enjoyed writing that one. Real challenge as well.
What's it about? Can you tell us a little bit?
Oh, yeah, it's about, it's kind of, we wanted to do a real locked room mystery sort of thing. So it's about a bunch of disparate characters who are all sort of survivalists. They're all fear the end of the world, so they've all invested in this underground bunker, luxury underground bunker. They get in, there's a threat, some kind of a virus that is spreading through the states, and so they all flee to this bunker and they get locked in, but it looks like they're locked in with one of them who's a murderer. So it's kind of like an Agatha Christie meets the apocalypse. I suppose it'd be the best way.
That sounds fantastic. I'm looking forward I'm looking forward to that, and I'm, you know, as always, looking forward and at the same time equally terrified of the concept.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Sarah. Thank you so much for speaking with us today.
Thank you very much. Really enjoyed chatting to you again.